Hello and welcome to episode 80 of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. It's great you're here, ready to dive into another episode about writing and publishing nonfiction. My name is Steph Caswell. I'm a multi-published author and a writing coach on a mission to remove the overwhelm, confusion, and frustration from the writing process and give you the confidence and knowledge you need to pursue your writing goals. I'm also dedicated to helping more women write business-boosting books to stand out, earn more, and be known in their niches. If you want to learn more about writing and publishing your business or nonfiction book, you can do two things. Firstly, sign up for my weekly email newsletter, The Write Stuff, full of writing and publishing advice straight to your inbox every Thursday. And grab a copy of my book, Dare to Write, which walks you step by step from your initial book idea to a published manuscript. It's available right now on Amazon and on my website. Links will be in the show notes. Let's start today's episode then, which is the first guest episode of 2025 with the brilliant Dr. Beth Mosley. Beth is one of the UK's most experienced and respected consultant clinical psychologists, working with children, young people and their families every day. Her book, Happy Families, How to Protect and Support Your Child's Mental Health, provides an evidence-based, realistic and practical guide where she shares the answers to the most commonly asked questions. What causes anxiety and how can I control it? How should you broach difficult conversations with your child around subjects such as low mood or even self-harm? And how can we support each other and communicate better? Happy Families takes an expert, honest and accessible approach to children's mental health, arming parents and carers with the tools they need to tackle anxiety, low mood and difficult behaviours, as well as the hope and reassurance to actively make a change with children from ages 4 right up to 21. In our thought-provoking discussion, we discuss how the pandemic transformed parenting and our relationship with technology, and what this means for our children's development and mental well-being. Why teenagers may seem more resistant to in-person social interactions now, and practical strategies for maintaining meaningful connections with them. The delicate balance between protecting our children and allowing them to develop resilience through managing their own challenges. Beth's journey from NHS workshops to international publishing, including how she wrote her book in just 6 months while juggling full-time work and single parenthood. And then we talk about the exciting opportunities that have emerged from publishing, including breaking mental health stigmas across different cultures and her plans to write another book in the future. This is such an important conversation for any parent navigating today's challenges, packed with practical advice and honest insights from both personal and professional perspectives. I hope you find it as valuable as I did. So Beth, thank you very much for joining me today. I have been really looking forward to this conversation. I'm a big fan of yours on Instagram, and since reading your wonderful book, Happy Families, I'm now such a fan as an author. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to meet with you as well today.
It's such an important book, and I think because it's a topic that I feel really, in terms of our young people, our children, it's just a topic that seems to be at the forefront of a lot of discussions recently: mental health, how we can support our children, and also, I suppose, how we can support ourselves when we're trying to support our children, because I'm sure, you know, that equally is an important part of the process of being a parent. So what led you to the point where you were thinking, right, this is a book I absolutely have to write? What was the sort of the path that led you to that?
Well, I've worked in the NHS for nearly, probably more than 20 years now. And I've stopped saying 20 and something, I've stopped adding up now. And I guess in the last sort of 5 years, particularly since the pandemic, the increase in need in this area is so astronomic that I just felt compelled to be able to give parents and families information as early as possible in their journey of parenthood, because I recognized that so many families were coming to see me and having waited for, you know, at least a year to just sit down and have a conversation with me, they'll be like, oh, if only we'd known this stuff a year ago or 2 years ago, it could have made a radical difference to our family's life. And I just felt really moved to provide the information I share and all the knowledge and expertise I've got, but also all the research knowledge and expertise in a really accessible way to families. I ran a parent workshop program through the pandemic to support parents, because all of a sudden I think parents suddenly realized, oh my goodness, we haven't got all the usual support networks in place. I'm very much the only person right now who's able to support my child at home in this unusual situation. So developed through the NHS a virtual workshop program, and what I discovered through that, which is what I've discovered in my in-person workshops before then, the more honest I was about the challenges I face as a parent, the more parents engaged with the content and the more positive the feedback was. And that's what parents wanted to hear, that this is really hard stuff for all of us, even those people who've got the biggest knowledge and skills because they're, you know, it's what they do for a living. It's still really hard. And here are some simple, realistic solutions that can give you more understanding, but also can give you some clear ideas about what to do about some of these things you might be struggling with. And so really that was the foundation for deciding to write the book.
It's so interesting that you say that, because my experience obviously is a completely different genre of nonfiction. When I first started writing, it was for teachers because I was a teacher. And I started writing because I, much like you, found that people were coming to me and needing support, but I was often saying the same things or suggesting the same things. And I just thought to myself, actually, all of this knowledge that I have around, you know, one of the books around behavior management, that there's so much there that I could be giving to people in book form. And it's interesting, isn't it, how these books sort of come out of the need or from people that they start to talk to you and they need support. And like you say, you know, lots of people, I mean, I remember when I was a deputy head and a Senko, the number of families that I would be trying to refer to CAMS for support, it was just the waiting list at that point, I think, was 18 months. And it was just such a difficult situation for parents to be in, for families to be in, because children were struggling. This was pre-pandemic, by the way, this is 10 years ago. It was still an issue there where they needed the help. And I think your book is brilliant at giving them that sort of stepping stone until they can be seen, if that's necessary, by a professional. Something like your book is just such a great way for them to get access to something that they feel is going to help them. And that's why I think books are just so brilliant, because they're just such an accessible way for a lot of parents, not all parents, but a lot of parents, to sort of be able to help their children. The pandemic did a lot around mental health. And obviously I've got teenagers and my two were going through the transition from primary school to secondary school at that point. And it was a lot. It was a lot to try and, even as a teacher, like a bit like you, lots of people said, oh, homeschooling, you should be okay with this because you're a teacher and my husband's a teacher. So I found that I could cope with that side of it, but the managing their mental health during that process. And one of my children, my eldest, has anxiety, so I thought it's actually getting them back to school afterwards that I felt was quite a challenge, because he'd always said to me, well, why don't you just homeschool me, mum, because you're a teacher, you could just homeschool me. And I was always like, no, you know, you need to go to school for socializing. And then obviously the pandemic happened, so he was like, well, you can teach me at home, because that's what you've been doing for all this time. How long do you think it's going to take for them to recover from that experience of the pandemic?
I think it's so variable, because so many young people you talk to about the pandemic and they say, oh, it was great. You know, there are some young people who actually really valued the pandemic as a time to step back from the busyness of life and school and have time at home with their families. And then you meet other families who the impact was literally catastrophic. I think what it's done for all of us is change our relationship with technology. And I think about my work-life balance before the pandemic, I never did an online meeting. It was unheard of. Now that we've gone on the other side of the pandemic, most of my life is in online meetings. Most of my demand on my time is from emails. And absolutely before the pandemic, that was not the case. So I think we've moved towards accepting digital technology as a much more integrated part of our lives across the board, as parents and adults, as well as young people. And I think that brings its own challenges. And I think it certainly brings challenges for the experience of childhood that our children are having. So I think the kind of trauma of the pandemic and the changes it made in individual families' lives are probably quite unique to different families. But what I'd say is that the mass impact on the way that we relate to one another and the way that we engage in activities is definitely going to have an impact for a longer period of time. And you could argue, well, that's progress, but it's at a cost. And I think a lot of the challenges that we're seeing for our children is they're not having the opportunities or the desire or motivation anymore to play freely in person with their peers. And I think that creates huge dilemmas for us as parents, particularly in my generation, because I did have an experience of growing up with playing outside and a lot of freedom as a child to do that, take risks, do things my parents had no idea what I was doing about. And not just my parents, but other people in my class. Whereas now young people don't have that freedom. Everything they do is tracked by either their peers or their parents. Every wrong move they make is documented, you know, forever on the social media platform. And I think it's a very high stress environment for our children to grow up in, where they're not getting the opportunity to develop some of those in-person skills and opportunity for risk management that I might have done, for example, when I was growing up. The challenge for us all is this is the reality of our lives. So where do we go from here? And how do we help our children manage the demands of the new world? Because ultimately, they're likely to get jobs in environments where there will be an expectation to engage digitally with their work, probably, but also enable them, childhoods that have the opportunities for creative endeavors, which fall outside of digital technology.
Yeah, it's so interesting because we live with my parents. So we live as an extended family. So there's my children, there's me and my parents. And it's so interesting. Sometimes around the dinner table, my dad, who's 80, he will share a story from when he was probably similar age to where my two are now. So 15 and 16, maybe a little bit younger. And he will just talk about how his mum would just, he would just go off for the day. He would go off for the day. And he'd be like, as long as he was home for dinner, that was pretty much the only instruction that he was given by my grandmother. And it was just a case of off you go. And he tells the children some stories of the things he got up to. And their faces, they honestly can't quite believe that that would be not allowed, but that was kind of just, there was that almost this freedom that just seemed so incomprehensible to the youth of today, because they're just sort of like, well, what do you mean you didn't have to, like, you know, you couldn't message home, or you couldn't, you know, you could just go out and what did you eat, granddad? And he would be like, well, you know, we'd sometimes find some berries off some bushes and all this sort of thing. And my two were like, but how did you know that they were safe to eat? He goes, well, we just sort of, you know, tried, you know, we just hope for the best, really. And he's so candid about it. And my two are just looking at him as though he's just like, it's like he comes from a different planet, not just a different generation. And I think it's so interesting to see, to live in the situation that I live in, where I've got my dad, who rarely uses his phone, probably doesn't even know how to WhatsApp. He has no interest in finding out how to either. He's quite happy. And then you've got my two, who everything is, their phone is everything. They talk to their friends on there. They watch whatever they want to be watching on there. And it's so central to who they are that it's so interesting to kind of see these two sort of ends of the scale. And I think you're so right about how can we bring a little bit more of you know, my dad's experience of childhood, my experience of childhood, much like you, you know, we you know, didn't have phones or anything. We went out and played and then we came back. And it's just, it's so interesting to see how can we get that balance back? Because it's almost like the pendulum has gone so far towards being, like you say, tracked. And, you know, I do it with my two. I think, oh, where, you know, where are they on their way home? So I'll find, you know, find my phone or find my iPhone or whatever. So I know where they are. And I just think it's an interesting one, isn't it? How we can get the balance back.
You know, it takes quite a lot of courage, actually, because if we're going to give our children more freedom outside of the online world, we have to sit with a little bit of discomfort because we might be asking our children to do things like, you know, get on a train or a bus to go into town on their own, and obviously the right sort of age, or go off and play in a park with their friends that they've had to bike to the park to, and you don't know where they are for 3 hours. And I think I'm really fortunate. I live in a village and I deliberately chose to live here so that my youngest now could have more opportunities to play out with his friends. What's been fascinating is to see how infrequently they do it of their own volition. They are so much more content and comfortable in their bedrooms on their gaming with their friends in the house two doors down on their game. So it's almost not a cultural norm for them to meet up and play together outside of their bedrooms and gaming. So I think it's something about how do we as adults be more intentional about what we're doing with our time to model what we hope that our children can do more of, and how do we expose them to more experiences where they are getting opportunities to go into a shop and order food, and they've got to order the food or answer a telephone call and speak on the phone. These are all things that teenagers are saying they're very anxious about, anxious to the point that they're posting TikToks about their levels of anxiety about speaking to someone on the phone or ordering something at a counter, paying for something in a shop. So our children aren't getting enough exposure to those types of opportunities to take those what feel like social risks. So the more that we can do to kind of do that with our kids, the younger they are, so they get that chance. And the more that we can do, I guess, to, when I think about my relationship with my phone, it's become an integral part of my life because it's the thing I use to do my online shop. It's the thing I do to check my Instagram, you know, how many people have liked my post today. It's the thing I do to check my work emails and my book related emails. And then I'm a single parent. I will use a dating app as well. And I'll get a recipe from it. So there's so many different things that my phone is used for that it's almost impossible to not have it right next to me. And sometimes one of the things I've tried really intentionally to do as a parent is a very, very simple thing, but it's been incredibly effective. And working full time, it's really hard to sometimes create space for your children where you're not completely exhausted and at your worst. And this works well for me because I can do it every day and it doesn't matter how tired I am. So I always watch something every night with my 11-year-old just for 10 to 20 minutes, a series that we're watching together, his choice invariably. So it's something he's interested in, but something I can tolerate and show an interest in too. So I genuinely want to go and sit with him. And what I have to do is I have to leave my phone in the kitchen, because if I go into that space with him and it's just for 15 to 20 minutes, I still find myself tempted to look at my phone to check some things. Oh, quickly send that message to my sister, or quickly sort that thing out for tomorrow. And I've noticed that my children notice me so much when they're expecting me to pay attention to something they're paying attention to. They get really irate if I get distracted by my phone. And then they'll get distracted by their phone. Literally, they'll go and get it, or they'll go. And so there's something about how can we be more intentional about how we use our own phones and create pockets of space in our family life where they are set very deliberately and intentionally aside so that we can engage in a different way either with the people that are around us, just noticing stuff more. Because, you know, when I'm preoccupied on my phone, I can't notice that my child's just come in the door and is really annoyed about something, you know. So I think there is something about, we have to be intentional about it because it's such a strong hook, and we're always going to be so busy. We're always going to have too much to do. We're always going to have a reason to be doing something. And so for me, as a really busy parent, it's almost, it is an addiction in its own right. And I have to sort of own that and explain to my children the neuroscience behind it, which I've kind of described in one of the chapters in my book. So they understand that it's not that there's something wrong with them that they feel so compelled to keep going on this thing. It's actually the way that the screens kind of tap into our neurochemicals and drive us to keep going, even though we kind of know, I've got to get off this, I've got to stop scrolling. And then we feel a bit low afterwards, and helping them understand that dopamine crash and those elements gives them more opportunity to kind of make sense of how it makes them feel and also make different choices with your support.
Yeah, I think you're so right. I often feel we underestimate what children can grasp in terms of, even if it's science like that, dopamine, that the social media companies, they have access to all this understanding of the neuroscience. They use it to make these apps what they are, to make them addictive, to keep you scrolling. Just, and I think when you explain that, I've explained it to my two about it, because sometimes they'll come off and they'll sort of say, like, oh God, I didn't realize how much time has passed. And those sort of comments, or they'll sort of feel the need to just check all the time. They just check their, if it's in their hand or nearby, exactly as you were saying, you feel compelled. All of us feel compelled to just check it. Is there something I've missed? But if it is out of the room, and I've had to do this myself recently, is I have to put it on charge somewhere else just to watch. If I'm watching something on the telly, I've found that I'm scrolling at the same time. And I just, when I realized what I was doing, I thought, how much stimulus do I need in order to, and then it absolutely freaked me out, because I thought, oh my gosh, not only am I watching something, but I'm not really watching it. I'm still scrolling something like you say, Instagram maybe, or, you know, and I'm just checking an email comes through. And I think, what? So I force myself. I put it somewhere else, because like you say, unless it's almost the out of sight, out of mind idea, isn't it? That if it's there, it's tempting. If it's not there, then I'm less likely to get up, you know, go and find it. It's, you know, it's absolutely fascinating. And at the same time, you're absolutely right, it's around modelling. And I had that question down around modelling the behaviours. So that's great. I would love to know, have you read The Anxious Generation?
Yes, I have. It's an excellent book. Yes, it really is. And I was reading something actually that the kind of community that, is it called Babel? Is it Babel? They've created, there's a website which often has really recent social commentary on some of the key issues. And one of the articles I was reading today was saying that FOMO, fear of missing out, is no longer an issue. It's actually fear of engagement, which is now the issue. And that young people used to be fearful of missing out through social media. Now they're fearful of actually engaging in doing stuff. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. So yes, it's an incredibly it's a bit overwhelming as a book, because there's so much there that suggests this is so problematic, and there are really nice ideas about how to resolve it, but it also seems a bit too idealistic to think that we can achieve that. And so I feel like it's one of those books which is got so much substance and years of research behind it, but can actually also feel quite overwhelming as well.
It's a balance, isn't it, as a writer, to make the case with the evidence and the research and to have that up your sleeve, but also, like, exactly like you say, not overwhelm the reader with too much of the research. That I'm always saying to authors, you know, is it absolutely essential for the reader to know this piece of research? in as much detail as you're saying it? Or is there a way that you can either, you know, paraphrase it into a, you know, into a sentence or two, or does it even need to be there? Because I think that's the danger, isn't it, as experts in something, that we know a subject inside out and we want to impart that knowledge to the reader, but it's trying to find the balance of what is absolutely essential for them to know. If it is essential, how can you write it in a way that feels that it isn't overwhelming and hard to understand? I think it's, I mean, I think your book does it brilliantly. You know, I love the case studies that you include and the stories that you include, just keeps it feeling manageable and that you're able to take from it what you need to take from it, and you're not having to look things up or find out what different words mean. And that's another thing I find with authors, is the simpler you can make the language, the more story-based you can make your writing, the much more engaging the book becomes. I do think what you're right, though. I think there is a movement, isn't there, around the smartphone-free childhood. I know that there's two women, I believe, behind that movement and trying to help parents who do want to make changes. And it is so hard to think, especially I feel for people whose children are just maybe coming through, I don't know, maybe they're 8, 9, 10. There's the question around smartphones or phones in general happening at school. Some people have phones, some people don't. And there's just a big pressure, isn't there, on parents as to make the decision. Do you get the phone? Do you not get the phone? If you don't get them a phone, will they be socially outcast? If you do get them the phone, how can you manage it so that it's not overtaking their whole lives? I don't know, have you found that with your own experience of being a mum, but also, you know, with patients that you see, that it's sometimes a point where it's an intervention is needed to bring back a better balance?
I think there's a couple of points really there. I think on one level, we're becoming paralyzed as parents by choice and fear of getting it wrong. So, you know, the dilemmas around whether to give your child a phone or not, what sort of phone, when exactly, parents really wanting a really prescriptive answer, like there is a definitive answer, has become something, I think, which is more and more of a problem in recent years. And I think that's part of the problem, is that we've almost become disabled by the fear of getting it wrong and the fear of damaging our children, and the fear of our children experiencing distress unnecessarily and how we might have contributed to that. Because we've got so much high hopes and aspirations for our children to have, you know, good childhoods where they come out at the other end and feel really positive about their childhood experience and go on to be successful adults. But I think some of that's driving the problem, if that makes sense, because there isn't necessarily one prescriptive answer. And it often takes us away from some of our instincts as a parent about what's right and wrong, and reinforces the belief that you know, one decision here and there can make such a significant impact on whether our child ends up okay or not. And typically with the young people I see in mental health services, there is not one event that has ended this child to be in a place where they need support from a mental health service. There is a series of events in their life, a collection of different factors that have added together to kind of create the particular challenge that family might be experiencing. And phones typically are not, I've never looked at, and I part of my job is I'm one of the single points of access for all the referrals that come into mental health services. And I've never seen a referral that says this child is being referred because of their phone or because of their digital device. I know there are some clinics in the country who work with young people with addiction. But it's always a number of things are going on in a child's life. And the phone or digital technology can become an important part of a child's way of almost coping sometimes with some of the challenges that they're having in their life. And that then feeds into the problem. So sleep is a really good example. We know how important sleep is for child development, brain development, and adult development. We know without sleep, we all go slightly mad because it's such an important component of our physical and mental health. So if you experience anxiety or low mood because something's happening in your life that's really difficult as an adolescent, maybe you've been bullied at school, maybe your parents are getting separated, maybe you've lost a really important grandparent or a pet, it's very typical for sleep patterns to be disturbed by anxiety or low mood. And so you might find you become anxious about going to bed at night because you don't want to go to bed and feel anxious and then start having dark thoughts about the things you're worried about. So you will then rely on your phone to support you with that. And then your phone will continue to keep you awake. And then you might look on your phone to things to help you with those feelings. And then they inadvertently take you off into a place where people have using really unhealthy strategies to manage their mental health. Telling you if you do this you'll feel better. And so you can see how it's kind of like it's really complex. I think there is something about in some ways we are demonizing the phone and digital technology a little, and we have to be careful about that because most of us are not in the position to throw out that digital technology. And actually, some of the best resourced families might be in the position to do that. But some of our most vulnerable and least resourced families are very unlikely to be able to do that. And that's not to say we don't attempt to be, you know, optimistic and intentional about protecting children and giving them a phone-free childhood. But I do think we also have to be really realistic about the fact that that for some families is impossible because they rely on that digital technology in lots of different ways. And they won't, because of the way that everybody's living their lives, they don't currently have the resource to not do that anymore. It is complex. And I don't know, in some respects, I feel like that's a message of hope because it's like, I don't think it is this. It's a simple solution to solve the problem because we can't just eradicate it. So we probably, I'm not entirely sure what the answer is, but I think it's believing, I suppose, in the capacity for resilience. And I think there's something about how do we get better at sitting with our children's distress? How do we get better at being curious about what's going on in our children's lives, whether it's online or in person? How do, when we ask them a question about how their day has been, enable them to really tell us, I just saw some porn online, Mum, and I didn't like it. Or I just fallen out of my best mate and I'm feeling really sad today. And we as parents cannot go, oh my God. We can go, okay, you know, let's talk about this. How can I help you work through this? I can't take away the pain. You can't take away the pain as a parent. It's one of those things we want to do, but it doesn't help your child in the long run learn how to, A, understand the pain is telling them something important about what's going on in their world, but B, learn that they can manage the pain. I think some of the most important, closest moments I've had in my lives, in my children's lives with them have been points when they have been suffering, and maybe I've been suffering too, and we found a way to work out together why are you suffering. It's because this thing is so important to me and that thing is in jeopardy, and the thing that's so important to you tells you beautiful things about you as a human being, how deeply you care about loyalty, how deeply you care about belonging, how deeply you care about love. You know, and I think that's some of the things that we're missing in our fear of our children becoming damaged by distress or our children experiencing negative events. We're missing the fact that those are children's capacity to manage life very much is going to require them to sit with some of that stuff and feel like it matters and it counts and I don't have to be afraid of it and this is what we're going to do next. And not sit alone with it and fear that it means that you're something wrong with you.
Sometimes I know how important communication is between us and our children, and for them to be able to have that confidence, that trust, that desire to speak to us. And I feel like when they get to teenage years, And I know lots of, you know, our listeners are sort of similar age to me, to us, with teenagers. And they tell you everything, don't they, when they're in their sort of preteen years. And then some parts you're just thinking, okay, just maybe you know, stop talking for just 5 minutes. And then they get to like being teenagers. And then it's almost like the absolute reverse. You know, it's almost they clam up and they don't want to talk. And I remember reading somewhere where they're saying, actually, we underestimate the fact that they do still want to talk to us. They do still want to be included in things. And just because maybe they spend some time in their bedroom, whatever that might look like in terms of length of time, they do still want to be included. And we can sometimes misinterpret the cues that they're giving off with, whether it be, you know, they don't want to join us for dinner, when actually they do still want to join us for dinner, or they don't want to talk to us about what's going on. How do you think then we can keep lines of communication open as our children enter the teenage years and sort of beyond, so that they do feel they can talk to us about things that might be worrying them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think the challenge for adolescents is that the challenge of adolescents is to actually grow apart from their parents and to actually establish their identity outside of their parents. And the brain chemistry and neuroscience, it drives a lot of the changes you see in adolescents as a form of helping them do that. So peer and social recognition and status becomes the most important thing of all. So you may feel like you've lost your teenager to their peer groups or their interests in their social world, and that everything that you've got to say doesn't really count anymore. And actually, there is a degree of brain changes that mean that adolescents actually listen to their peers and much more than they listen to adults. And so when you know that, you know, your approach to having a relationship with your adolescent probably needs to be different from your approach to having your relationship with them when they were a younger child. It needs to come from a stronger position of reciprocity and mutual respect. And that's really hard when your adolescent is behaving in a way which just makes you want to come down on them like a ton of bricks because they're not being respectful or they're really pushing the boundaries. And a few things that I feel like I've had to really learn and work on as a parent, knowing this stuff, particularly my daughter, who's a much more challenging personality than my son's. So it's kind of created a different reaction and response in me, and she's pushed different boundaries and different buttons for me. A couple of key things. Our children as adolescents are programmed to be exceptionally sensitive to judgment and criticism and tone of voice and facial expressions. So I don't know if you've had this experience, but my teenagers will tell me, stop shouting, Mom. Stop being cross to me, Mom. Stop looking at me like that, Mom. And I'm like, I'm not shouting. This is my normal voice. This is my happy face. And I think it does it's hard because it puts more pressure on you as a parent, but it does mean that quite often our teenagers are viewing us as a lot more hostile and judgmental than actually we feel we are. And so what it often means is I have to do a lot of explaining what's actually going on in my mind rather than letting them assume I'm in a mood with them or I'm grumpy about them or I'm judging them. My daughter's fake eyelashes today, you know. So I think there's something about how do you articulate what's going on in your mind as an adult so that they're a bit clearer that you're not necessarily taking the view that you've got no time for them. And I think you, because of the loads of things that are an option for teenagers today compared to my generation, for example, like, I think we have to work a lot harder as parents to take an interest in our children's teenagers' worlds. So the kind of access points for me of being to my adolescents has been being interested in what's going on for them, even if it's something I don't even agree with that highly or don't like. I used to be TikTok, but now I'm kind of on social media. I get it more and I'm much more. And taking an interest for a period of time in my my teenager's world on TikTok and show me that. And what is the trend on Skims at the moment? And you know, they kind of go, oh, Mom, you're just so out of touch. But she always ends up showing me. So And I think it's about not giving in to that initial resistance, that little cringe, you know, that they get when you do make an effort, and just kind of having the confidence to genuinely keep those lines of communication open. And, you know, little things like saying goodnight every night. You know, my daughter always, sometimes when she's in a really bad mood, slams her door. And the last thing I feel like I can do is say goodnight to her. But I try every night to just put my head around the door and say, goodnight, I love you. And it's something about maintaining those little opportunities for connection consistently that let your child know you're there and waiting. Actually, when they do really need to speak to you, you're there. And your response isn't going to be a massive overreaction and, oh my God, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. It's going to be like, okay, I'm going to listen to you. And then from there, we'll make a plan. And I think if your children, your teens trust that, then it just sort of makes you be able to settle a little bit as well, because you believe, actually, if my teen really needs to speak to me about something, I do think they would come and call on me. So it requires a lot of extra work that I think my parents never even had to consider doing. But I think that is it. We're living in a very different world with very different options for our adolescents to push us out of their world, to be honest. So yeah, those things have helped me over the years.
Yeah, thank you. That's so helpful. I must just say before we move on to the book stuff, I decided I was going to play the Xbox with my children recently. The hilarity that ensued with me trying to work out how to drive a car around this Formula One track. They still talk about it now, because I've always sort of said, oh, what are you playing? Like, you know, and then I said, oh, I'll have a go at this. And they were both like, oh, Mum, do you even know how to do it? And I said, no, I don't have this. They were trying to teach me how to use the controller. And honestly, I think at one point they were both just lying on the floor laughing at me, trying to work out how to drive this car. So I think it is funny that, like you say, it's just finding these small moments where you can have those shared experiences, or you're taking an interest in what they're doing, that you're right, that hopefully that when you're doing the small stuff with them, that actually when it's the big stuff, they will come and talk to us. So yes, that is even now, that's even months later, they still talk about when I was trying to drive the car on the Xbox game. So I'm somehow it's managed.
And it's lovely for them to be the expert. I think as an adolescent, you want to feel like you're the expert. And my youngest is often asking me to watch him on Fortnite, and I've got no interest whatsoever. But if I sit there and watch him, I learn about why it's so important to him, the camaraderie he's got his friends, why when I call him down in the middle of a game, he just can't come down for dinner. And it kind of means that we can then have a bit more of a shared understanding of how, you know, how we manage when I call you down for dinner because you're in the middle of a game and things like that. So it kind of, you get an insight into your child's world and what's important to them. And it isn't sometimes the things that you assume it is. It's the things that you value too are what makes this game important to your child. And so, yeah, that's a really lovely example.
I'd love to say I was an expert, but now terribly I'm not. Anyway, I would love to, just talk to you a little bit about your book writing experience and how you found becoming an author and sort of your journey to get published, but also sort of to consistently keep your book kind of within the content you put out on your Instagram, and, you know, the kind of opportunities that you've hopefully had off the back of writing it. How was the experience of, you know, you've got a book deal, you know, and here you are now, you need to write it. How did you find the writing of it, you know, itself?
Well, And I suppose I was in an unusual position because I had an idea to write this book, and my idea became a reality in a very short period of time, because I was so fortunate about I had an opportunity to speak to a publisher about my idea, and he said, this is a great idea, I'll publish it. And then I was really fortunate because I got an agent almost immediately who then gave me the advice I needed about how to write a really good proposal, and then was able to put that forward to the big publishers and go to auction. And before that happened, I had no concept about the publishing world. I had no idea about it at all. And it was a kind of I'd say it was luck, but it was one person who happened to point me in the right direction to the next person, and that very quickly became the right person, because it was the right idea at the right time and I had the right credentials. And I work full time for the NHS. As a lot of authors work, they have to, because you cannot really make money from books, certainly finding that out. So it's something that I had to fit in the writing of my book in my time when I wasn't at work. And I've got three kids and I am a single parent, but their dad is very involved with, you know, he's a co-parent and we live in the same town. So he has them every other weekend. So my writing schedule had to fit into my remaining annual leave for the year and asking my ex to have my children during that annual leave so I could just focus on writing, and that every other weekend. And I had I had less than 6 months to write the book from beginning to final submission. I think I got the deal at the end of August and I submitted the final proposal at the end of February. And I had started writing the chapters off my book proposal, which my book proposal, I managed to just have, I just had sort of like this genius sense of what this book needed to have, the order, the way to do it. And actually the book is almost identical to my proposal, the chapter, the layout, the parts. I think I moved one thing around, which is quite incredible, really, because I didn't spend a long time putting that proposal together. But I think it was like 25 years of life and work and ideas that just sort of streamlined itself into the proposal. And then I think the bit that made the writing easy for me in some ways was the pressure of a deadline, because it meant I couldn't be too precious about every single line. And it's all in me because I've been living and breathing it for my whole career. But also I wanted to embed stories about my own life and the life of the people I've met with over the years, which again made it easier for me, because I just remember sitting like, I've got to write a chapter in 2 days and I don't quite know how I'm going to begin. How am I going to begin? And I just like would let my brain go into, what's a good way to start this? What's a good story to start this chapter with? What's a hook? And then I'd come up with the memory or the event and I'd just start writing and it flowed from there. So I feel like I look back at my book now and I think, how did I write that? It was like it was someone else writing it, not me. And sometimes I would experience that at the end of the day, like I'd gone into this kind of weird place where someone else inside of me was writing the book for me. It was so strange. It was surreal. It was a wonderful experience. And so it feels like almost magical. And I don't think that's necessarily everyone's experience of writing. It's probably what everyone has moments of writing like that. But I think because my deadline was so tight and the pressure was on me, and I do perform well under pressure, I, rather than just having that for one chapter or two chapters, I had it for every single chapter consistently, or else I could never have done it. It would have never been done in time. And so it was, yeah, a really interesting experience. I think the hardest bit about writing a book is launching it and it going out there into the world and then not really anything happening. I think that was harder for me than writing it, because I've come to this with no social media presence whatsoever. So I didn't have a platform or, you know, any followers to be able to shout out, here's my book, buy it, you know. I'm not a known psychologist I have done lots of stuff with the media, but just for free, you know, just when the BBC needs some help with a story, you know, not on a kind of breakfast TV show or something. So I'm not a known quantity in that world. So I think for me, what I found difficult, probably more than the writing of the book, funnily enough, was the anxiety about it going into the world, and then the feeling that you don't know what people think of it, you don't know how much of an impact it's making. And I think you also set yourself up to want it to be a bestseller immediately, because, like, I think that's the pressure we put ourselves under, isn't it? And then feeling disappointed when it isn't. When I look back now, of course, it would require some kind of miracle for that to have happened. But because of the kind of, I'm not linked into that world. And I've seen lots of people recently on Instagram who are writing their second books or third books or fourth books. And they've got that followership. They've created that platform. They've got people who adore them, who will be pre-ordering their book because they just can't wait to hear what they've got to say next. And I know I'm not in that place yet. Whether I ever will be, I don't know. But I think I was a bit naive, really. I just thought, well, if you've written a good book and it's helpful, then it will sell.
You would hope. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. I think, and it's a very common belief, honestly, with all the authors I speak to, the authors I work with, it's often, you know, that you think you hit publish, or you it's published day and your book's out there. And actually, I truly think that is where the hard work really begins, is once the book is written and out there. And of course, it's challenging to write a book. I'll never shy away from saying that, but it's the continual promotion of it, the marketing of it, the selling of it, keeping people interested, getting new readers all the time. It's such a challenge.
It's definitely the hardest bit. And I was surprised about how little my publisher actually did, and how once they've done their initial launch publication, you really are kind of left to yourself, which sort of doesn't make sense to me, because I think you invested a lot in this title. But my understanding is that's just industry standard. I've sold the book in so many different countries, and I've noticed that different publishers have different approaches. So my publisher in Romania is constantly trying to think of new ideas of how to kind of keep the book alive and do promotions around, you know, ensuring that it's staying fresh in people's minds as a resource. And that's been quite refreshing, actually. And I think that's been a really incredible experience, because I just thought about, you know, writing the book in the UK, hadn't considered the international market. And I had a call with China this morning with the Chinese readership, and hearing how they're receiving the book and how helpful it is for them based on the cultural differences in parenting and approach to parenting, plus the high demand around mental health in China, was so inspiring this morning. And then that makes you think, oh gosh, I wish I could just do this all the time. I wish I wasn't constantly trying to juggle the demands of a full-time job where I'm doing the real work with families with mental health need. It makes you want to be able to kind of have more space to pursue helping people at that grassroots level. It's created more dilemmas for me, really, about how to use my time, and more pressure, because the Instagram pressure is massive. Like, you've got to think, right, I've got to so you kind of, it leaves you in a place of never really being able to think you've done okay, or you can relax, because it's so perpetual. And I think that can be quite challenging. And I'm not linked in with lots of other authors, so I don't get that circle of people going, oh yeah, that happens to me. And like, maybe that's something I need to think about doing, is becoming a bit more linked in with other authors, because then you feel less alone with it, don't you?
Yeah, I wonder, because I had Emma Hepburn on the podcast last season. She was fantastic. And I also met Anna Martha this weekend, and we were just chatty about all sorts of things. And she was, she's very honest, isn't she, on her Instagram about, you know, what it's like to be raising kids, and that sometimes it's, you know, not, we shouldn't be hard on ourselves in the process of, you know, being parents and mothers. And I just thought, you know, it is all about linking up, and, you know, if you can, because what I find as an author is when you find other authors in your space, or other authors who are, you know, even remotely talking about what you're talking about, if you can just get a group of you who can just be super supportive of each other's work all the time, it can make such a big difference. And if it helps, I have been part of working with a Sunday Times bestselling author, five times Sunday Times bestselling author, and he you know, the campaign, once the initial campaign for the new book is over, it is down to him and the team to continue the promotion of it, and he's with Penguin, so, you know, big publisher. So it is one of those things where it is whoever you are, they will offer you a certain amount of support. And obviously he's one of their big sellers, so he will get probably more support than the average author. But it is a case of, okay, right, the campaign's over, the 3 months of support from Penguin is over, it's now up to you to kind of crack on and continue to sell them. So it is, and it's an ongoing, you know, just got to keep doing it and keep talking about it, and it can feel so...
No one really prepares you for that, do they? Unless you've kind of really... I didn't research it massively. It's all been new to me. I read a book called Yellow Face on holiday, and I found it so fascinating because it describes the publishing world so well, and it described my experience, and I thought, wow, you know, for someone who has been through the publishing process, this kind of shone light on the fact that this is it. So, you know, what my experience isn't particularly unique, and I really enjoyed reading that, largely because it kind of helped, yeah, describe something that I'd not seen described before like that.
Yeah, I loved it too. I loved it. I can totally see, if you're an author and you've got a friend who's like the big name, how challenging it must be to kind of keep your expectations and your eyes focused on your stuff and not be totally bamboozled by their success. Do you feel like you've had some interesting opportunities off the back of publishing? You know, when you've published a book, have you done things that you never imagined doing? Because quite often that can be the case. Even if, you know, it wasn't quite what you thought it might be, these opportunities have come about.
The things that stand out most for me is the international publishing. And, you know, going to Bucharest for a book launch and being out there for a week and having all opportunities to be on live TV, talking about things that are totally stigmatized in Romania, and being able to open up conversations with people that are just not standard in that country. And it felt like I was part of leading a revolution into equipping families and parents to have the knowledge that they can't easily access themselves. That was one of the most incredible experiences, I'd say, that I've had, because I just remember sitting there with a translator, with this audience, and these incredible speakers, a psychiatrist, a psychotherapist in the country, who are well known in the country, and an educator. And the way they spoke so passionately about the challenges in their country and the need for kind of how can we support and our children have a better start in life. It was awe-inspiring. I felt like I was in a movie set, like in a kind of film of the beginning of a revolution. And I think that experience, like, has probably been the most kind of awe-inspiring moment probably since I published my book, really, that my book had led to that. And I think other things are like just, you know, talking to journalists who ring you up and say, there's this big story today, can I just speak to you for 10 minutes? And then that becomes an article and a really best-selling part of the Times, you know. It just seems incredible that you know, your knowledge is really valued in times like this.
Do you think that you've got another book in you? Do you feel like that you've got something else to share in that sort of way?
Well, I didn't until about that week off I mentioned. I had a week off a couple of weeks ago. We didn't really do anything. And then I started. Lots of people have been asking me on Messenger and on Instagram about how to support their children through divorce and separation. Really, really distressed families who are so just anxious about the process and destroying and just damaging their children with it. Actually, I spoke about it to the Chinese expert earlier today, and they were saying it's a real taboo topic in China, actually, and that they would really value any advice and guidance on it and destigmatizing it. So I started to think, should I write a book on, you know, the challenges of separation and divorce? But obviously I've been through that myself, and I've got lots of friends and colleagues, and I see lots of young people and families who are going through that. And I think, you know, about half the population get divorced, don't they? So I thought I started to have a thought, because I hadn't been, because of my work and because the book promotion takes so much. And I kind of like, I want this to be a bestseller before I do that, you know. It's kind of like, I have started to the process of thinking, and it got me excited, actually. I was thinking, I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I know I did it before, so I can do it again. But it's finding the thing that will be most helpful where there isn't already something in the space doing that, and I think that's the key, really.
Oh, it's exciting. Well, I'll be following along to see whether that comes into fruition, but it does sound very exciting. And I often find that when a book idea comes to me, it just sort of won't leave me alone until I write it. You know, if it's one that I really feel strongly about, just over and over, it will just keep tapping away at the inside of my skull, as if to say, you know, you need to write this now. So I wonder whether that's I wonder whether it'd be the same for you.
Now, that's amazing to know. So if it keeps doing that, let it marinate for a while. And I might do a few posts after the back to school, back to uni times past, just asking for people's thoughts and views and stuff. Because, yeah, I think it's important to know what's important to the people out there really struggling with the challenges of these things.
Absolutely. And then my last question, which I ask everybody, is, if you were going to give one piece of advice to an aspiring writer, somebody who's listening who maybe has that book that's tapping away inside, what piece of advice would you give them around writing or publishing that you think would be helpful?
I think there's something about just doing it. I think in some respects, my story is very much I had an idea and within a week I was doing it. And if I thought about it too long, I'd have never have done it. This book would never exist. And the same is true for my actual writing of it. I tried to just do it rather than get caught up with it being absolutely perfect. And I think that really helped me not get stuck, because I believed, I suppose, that I had a really important story to tell, and that with the support of an editor, obviously, that they would, you know, and I think that's it. It's a team. Like, if you're going to enter into the world of publishing a book, you know, it's not you doing it on your own. You know, you do need a team, whether it's the people in your life who are going to bring you a cup of tea or look after your kids, or you know, say, okay, you can lock yourself away for a week and just get into it, or it's the people who give you a glass of wine when you're just frazzled and you don't think you can do anymore. Or it's, you know, the team who are supporting you actually get the book to publication and then market it and encourage you. And I say in my book about find your cheerleaders, that's what you need, because it's really lonely and it's really scary to put your ideas on a page and then have other people look at them and maybe not like them, maybe criticize them. It requires a huge amount of courage. So I'd say you have nothing to lose. Be brave and just do it, and, you know, use people and the team around you to help you develop and grow the idea. And you need that in order to make the idea viable. So if you hold on to it and you don't take it anywhere and you don't explore it and you don't talk about it, your idea won't necessarily grow into something that people want and need to read. So it's like the process of sharing your idea is all part of writing. And there are things that I have changed based on sharing the idea and then people going, oh, no, that really worked. So it's, although writing is quite an insular activity, you need other people to support you with what you create in the end, both for motivation and encouragement, but also for growth and development.
I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. I do think that community is key, and support is key to keep you going, because it can, like you say, feel a very lonely experience. But this has been such a valuable, brilliant conversation. So thank you so much, Beth. I will put links to the book and to your socials in the show notes for everybody, and obviously I'll be sharing when the episode goes out plenty to do with the conversation. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it, and I wish you the best of luck with your hopefully maybe the next book, but also with your current book.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that episode with the brilliant Dr. Beth Mosley. What I took away from it was her emphasis on maintaining authentic connections with our teenagers while navigating the digital age, something that can seem, from my own experience, quite challenging, and I'm sure you probably feel that too. Her insights about not demonising technology, but rather finding intentional ways to create phone-free moments, take a genuine interest in our children's online worlds, and maintain those small daily touch points like saying goodnight, even during challenging times, really resonated. She reminded us that while parenting today looks very different from previous generations, what matters most is keeping those lines of communication open and helping our children build resilience, even when that means sitting with their discomfort rather than trying to fix everything for them. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on your favourite podcast platform. And if you know someone else who'd enjoy this episode, please do share it with them. I'd be so grateful. I'll link to Beth's book and her social media in the show notes. And I just want to extend a big thank you to her for coming on the show. Until next time, happy writing.